Hi, friends. It's Susan Blackwell from The Spark File, your one-stop shop for creativity where our doors are open. And if you smell something delicious, that's because Laura Camion and I have been cooking up something special, something designed to make a big difference in people's creative lives. Enter The Brave Creative, a free 5-day guided adventure to rediscover the vitality, energy, and possibility in your creative process. Whether you're a writer, a performer, a baker, a candlestick maker, navigating the creative process can be a bear. But never fear, there's power in numbers at The Spark File. So let's link arms and make the trip together. It's May 13th through 17th, 7 p.m. Eastern, less than 1 hour per day. And if you can't join live, don't worry about it. You can watch the replay. Join us by going to thesparkfile.com to register. And hey, if you're not familiar with The Spark File, first of all, welcome to the podcast. Secondly, we work with hundreds of creatives of all different kinds who are ready to take their next big step. We help folks fear less and create more in a community that is so fun and vibrant. And if you have joined us before, know that we are going deep with The Brave Creative. So buckle up, Buttercup. It is going to be an awesome adventure. Go to thesparkfile.com to register, but do it soon because it all starts May 13th. Thesparkfile.com. Register now.
The Spark File podcast may contain profanity and other adult content. Please use your discretion.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my spark file.
Spark file.
Could be something that I want to make or how I want to be. I pump it in my spark file.
Spark file.
I jump into my spark.
Welcome to The Spark File, your one-stoppy, old-timey shoppy for creative inspiration.
I'm Lauren Camion.
And I'm Susan Blackwell. If you're joining us for the first time, you are so welcome. You may be asking yourself, what exactly is a Spark File? Where do I get one? What do I file in it? These are good questions, and we've got answers.
A Spark File is a place where you consistently collect all of your inspirations and fascinations.
So here's the deal. Just between us chickens.
Gather up here. Get close.
We are makers who make all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. And if you're like us and you're making stuff all the time, or even if you just want to be making stuff all the time, you know the wellspring of inspiration can run a little dry.
So we're on the lookout for fresh ideas, images, and inspiration that spark our creativity and pique our curiosity, things that inspire us to get up off of our asses and make things like this podcast.
Or a 500, 1,000, or 2,000 piece of art.
Or a meditation on dying that provides so much inspiration for living.
Ooh. We've got a combo for you today. Every episode, we're going to reach into the Spark File and exchange some sparks. And from time to time, we're going to talk to some folks who spark us too.
And if you're not careful, you might just get your life affirmed. So without further ado, let's open up
the Spark File.
Just one of the hottest introductions in show business.
That was the best.
Hi, Cams.
Hi, Blackwell.
So happy to see you.
I'm excited to see you too.
Any business?
And talking to you like on mic because we save so much up. I'm like, finally we can talk.
This spark that I'm sharing with you today, I have been waiting to, there are so many sparks within the spark.
Oh my God.
That I have been waiting patiently to share with you because I have ideas, real big ideas to share.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Before we start rocking our sparks,
yes.
I just wanted to acknowledge and shout out the many fine listeners who have been writing in.
Oh my God.
Sending us across all sorts of, through our website, thesparkfile.com, through email, thesparkfile@gmail.com, through social media, @thesparkfile, across all those platforms. We have been getting sparks. We have been getting questions. We have been getting It's so much great.
It's so fun. And I think we're both excited to share that we're going to do at least an episode or many episodes where we do listener sparks.
Somebody sent me a spark. I will be honest with you. Somebody sent me a spark through the Spark File Instagram account.
Yeah.
It was such a good spark. I knew that you hadn't read it yet because it was unread.
You bastard.
I took it. I deleted it so you wouldn't see it. It's so good. And so I'd like to thank the sender of that
like
spark.
That.
You'll be fully recognized during a full episode.
Wow.
Yeah. Also, Brady Peters,
Brady,
who we met at our Nashville workshop at the Story Gathering.
Yes.
Brady Peters is a human walking, talking spark. And then he sent us the most beautiful email, including a link to his new newsletter that he has launched. It's called the A to Z, and it is essentially a monthly newsletter that is a spark file organized from A to Z.
This is crazy. There's like 26 sparks.
26 sparks. And he did something recently that I thought was so smart because X is so hard.
X is a question mark.
A is Amelia Earhart. Do you know that they think they found Amelia Earhart? It's so good. It's such a great, diverse spark file. But, X has become, is his wild card for him. So he's like, I get to choose what X is because X is so fucking hard.
I love it. And also because it's your spark file. You get to do
whatever you want, Brady Peters.
Give yourself a gift.
If people want to subscribe, I think you should. I love
it.
It's
awesome.
It's just like so clean. It's not a lot of like, it's just so clean and beautifully put together. It's, the website is the A2Z. theatoz.substack.com. So go on, sign up. You will not regret it. I enjoy
Brady,
it so much.
Thank you,
Brady,
so much.
And I would not be surprised if one of the sparks within the A to Z newsletter made it onto the spark file too. So good. So good.
I'm excited to do those episodes and to dig into like choosing some listener sparks. I think it's going to be super fun to go down some rabbit holes that we like literally weren't even on our radar.
Love it. I'm so excited because we can't know all the sparks.
We can't. No one can.
No one, no single human can. We're trying our best, but no one can. The other thing I want to say is the word douche nozzle. That goes out to listener Jeff Spitz. Jeff Spitz,
what?
Who is loving and binging the podcast, but he really wanted me to say the word douche nozzle. And so Spitzy, that one goes out to you.
So that's how it works. A word needs to be said.
I don't. Do we really want to set that convention in motion?
Well,
it's more like a dare. It's like I dare you to say this on mic.
And you just dared the wrong person because you know Blackwell will say it.
But if somebody's like, "Can you wish my friend Lauren a happy birthday?" I'm gonna be like, "Go fuck yourself, Lauren." But words like douche nozzle, sure, I'll make time for that. I'll waste our time and yours, gentle listeners.
Thanks, Susan.
That's all the business I have for today. Do you have any other business?
That was important stuff. I don't think I can top that.
It's important work.
Do
you
want
to rock
ready
some
to
sparks?
Freaking spark it up.
Okay, I will say that my spark is a little... Do you want to go first or should I go first? That's a question on the table.
Well, I wanted to hear the end of that sentence. It's a little...
It's a little longer. It's a little more involved.
Okay. I think I should go first.
Okay.
Mine is not so long or involved.
Great.
But mine is fun and light.
Oh,
and
good.
I don't know how light it is. I shouldn't make promises. So I have titled my spark this week. My spark is called A Piece, P-E-A-C, of the Puzzle. A Piece of the Puzzle.
Oh my God.
Or maybe Puzzle Piece. I think I'm changing. It's going to be Puzzle Piece, P-E-A-C-E.
This is a fantastic use of everyone's time.
Well, I could have also named it A Spark of a Million Metaphors, but we'll get there.
All right. Excited.
I'm going to start with a quote, though, from a BuzzFeed article. That's right, BuzzFeed.
BuzzFeed does some good work.
Okay.
Don't sleep on BuzzFeed.
This was by Rachel Wilkerson Miller, and the quote is, "When it feels like the world is falling apart, literally putting something back together can feel powerful."
This is a puzzle spark. This is I know that your household will enjoy a puzz.
Well, Susan, since you follow my beloved Wes on social media.
I do. The West Day Show.
The West Day Show. You already know that he's gotten a little bit into puzzling lately.
He really will.
He will puzzle.
He's like a full-on grandma at this point.
So it's funny you say that.
He has puzzle accessories that he's purchased right. just for puzzling.
And do you know that friends have gotten in touch? Like, he has reconnected with people from his past because they're like, where did you get those? And he's like
his
proudly.
Puzzle, yes, his puzzle trays.
His puzzle trays.
He has. So when he's divide, my observation is yes. it looks like when he is in the liminal space of working on a puzzle.
That's right.
I learned that at story. When he is, he has puzzle trays that are shaped like puzzles pieces, puzzle pieces. And he can be like, oh, here's the snowy
here
part
the
of the thing.
Part. Here's then the
we'll
map
put that over
part.
Here. This is clearly the part that is the rhinoceros in the lower right-hand corner.
Yeah. And then you can stack them. They stack. So if you want to put them away, it's
get that
easy.
Puzzle off the dining room table.
That's right.
Is what Wes's
it's time
mother
for dinner.
Sounds like.
Yeah, he can like easily stack them up and move them.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is like he started to get into this puzzling phase of his life when he was going through a bit of a tough time.
Mm.
Like our little kitty died and yes. we had had Kitty for 20 years. Yeah. He had Kitty for 20, like Kitty predated me in the life of Wes. And he was really feeling and still is feeling that loss.
Yeah.
Kitty was like
that
his
was a hard
shadow.
One. Yeah.
Oh, and then Kitty. I know he was like the best cat in the world. And anyway, so he really needed something to quiet his mind and focus his mind. And a friend of his like introduced or reintroduced him to puzzling and he really took to it. And I'm not going to lie, you know, I was definitely one who'd be like, okay, grandpa, what's going on here? And then sat down and started puzzling with him. And I'm like, okay, let me dig in a little bit to this.
This is so sweet.
So what he likes to do is put on music. Oftentimes it's classical music. It's like the BBC.
Or he could put on a podcast.
Yes.
May I recommend the Spark File?
Or he'll be like, babe, I'm puzzling and I'm listening to the Spark File, which is super sweet.
That is sweet.
And, or he puts on Spotify, like, he loves the Billy Ocean channel that has like Whitney Houston classics and Lionel Richie. And you just never, like, this guy and his music choices, like, is always such a delightful surprise. Hall & Oates might just pop in there.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And it's so joyful. And so Wes will like take care of the music choices. We'll sit down and we'll puzzle, which has been amazing. But lately he's been getting into entertaining himself, making these little videos of his puzzles.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, this I've missed.
Well, for his social, he'll like, let's say he's doing a Game of Thrones puzzle with like the big dragon and the Night King and Jon Snow and whatnot. He'll make a little video, a little progress video with like music from Puff the Magic Dragon and combine it with this puzzle and
that's
just
creative
really
sparks.
Just entertaining himself. Yeah. And then people get a kick out of it. And then he's like, oh, I'm discovering friends like online that like these things that I didn't
share
know
this.
Anything
yeah.
about them.
I love that.
Which is really, really neat. But, you know, he also has an awareness that, you know, it's not the coolest thing to do. And like,
we've called him Manny and Grandpa, I think.
Just in the past 5 minutes. So he gets a little
bit of that.
Yeah, he gets both like reconnection with people he didn't know had this passion as well.
And just hard shade.
And then also total shade. He'll be like the sweetest thing. I'm sorry, babe, I'm telling a story. But like the sweetest thing he said to me, as though it was a surprise a bit, like, you know, I'm getting the sense that like puzzling's not really the coolest thing to do. And I was like, yeah, babe, you just now caught on to that?
I don't know. I think it's one of those things that swings around so far that it comes back to cool.
I think that's right. And we're going to talk a little bit
and
about that.
Anything, like you were saying, anything that like calms the mind, anything that eases the spirit. Another puzzler that we know who is never calmer than when they are doing a puzzle is our friend Michael Barres, who I referred to several times in the Larry Nassar episode. He is like on group vacations and stuff. He is never more, in my observation, never more chill than when he is doing a puzzle. And that I even call his mind a puzzle mind. Michael Barres has a puzzle mind. He's able to hold a lot of, he's very intelligent. He's able to hold a lot of information in his brain. He's able to, he has like weird version recall of, oh no, there was a rewrite you did three times ago that like his mind is what I call a puzzle mind. And it's also quieted by puzzling.
That is delightful to know.
Yeah.
Apparently, like Jeff Bowen wrote to us on social as well.
There you go.
You know,
Michael Barres' husband
was so delighted. Yeah. He was like, "Jeff loved my bird puzzle."
Yeah, Jeff's a bird nerd.
I mean,
and a little bit of a puzzle nerd.
Just so sweet and so joy inducing. And so, of course, I was like, "Yeah, babe, I'm not sure it is the coolest thing, but who cares?
Who cares?
He doesn't care. He's like, I know, whatever.
Yeah, good.
He's never led his life.
We're going to bully you, Wes, but who cares?
That's right. But don't care. Try not to care when we teach you. But no, he's never lived his life in, you know, in terms of like, oh, I want my free time must be spent doing some trend setting things. Not his concern.
Yeah.
So he's really loving it. And I'm loving when I like sit down with him, it's really soothing and meditative. And I started to, you know, think further about this. And I was like, I'm just going to ask around a little bit. I'm going to touch base with a couple friends just on the puzzling front. And one friend, super fun, she is like, oh my God, I just did like a hypnotherapy session. And she's like, I was inside my mind palace and I went into a room and my therapist was like, if you need to do something, do it. She does her whole therapy session. And then her therapist was like, okay, did you do something when you were in that room? And she's like, yeah, I had to stop and do a puzzle. And she's like, I love jigsaw puzzles. I love them. So I was like, that's super cool. And I've had several friends, like almost universally, I would say, like a huge sigh or like a, wow, I used to love doing puzzles, or I'd love to do some puzzles, but like somehow life has gotten in the way and we're busy, and taking the time to do something that seems so simple and maybe not goal oriented is like a luxury that we don't allow ourselves anymore. And I definitely think I would fall into that camp normally, like if Wes wasn't doing it.
As you are talking, I'm just thinking, even if I wanted to, I don't know when we would find, I mean, we have a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah.
You and I have a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah.
Nathan and I have a lot of stuff going on. And I'm like, huh, when would we squeeze in the puzzling? But maybe like when our house is done being renovated, maybe then when we're done, you know, doing
you
that.
You know, but I think we're going to talk a little bit more about what it does to the brain. And you may be fulfilling the same thing that it does in
with
other ways
meditation.
With your meditation.
Yeah.
And you make time for that every day, which is interesting.
I sure do.
And I think that like something like puzzling, like I said, like I would be like, oh no. I have things to cross off my list. I have things that I have to achieve and do. So it's interesting how many people may feel a little bit of a longing for the thing that it gives them.
Mm-hmm.
Several people said that they lived in households or within family dynamics that were a bit more chaotic, or maybe had parents with some obsessive compulsions or neuroses that kept them anxious.
Yes.
And that in these moments, when a family member got out a puzzle for them to do together, like it quieted the mental noise.
Yes.
And that as they worked together, like peacefully, like they had some of their best family time together around a puzzle.
This makes so much sense to me. Yes.
It's pretty cool. So then I remember when we were talking to Leslie Odom Jr., he was answering one of our questions and he was trying to describe a feeling, and he was like, that moment when you find the exact right puzzle piece, like the one you're holding in your mind and you see the shape and you know exactly what it is and it's going to fit there and you know where it is.
Yes.
And it snaps into place.
Yes.
And he like looked at me in that moment. He's like, you know, and then he was like, you know, and I'm like, I do know. Cause I just did a puzzle with Wes. I was like, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And it's that very satisfying feeling of like finding the answer that has maybe existed in your subconscious and it just all comes together perfectly. Mm. So it was neat. It's like now that I have an awareness of it,
yeah,
I'm seeing and hearing more like when this topic kind of comes up naturally and the depth of feeling that people have about it. But so for the purpose of this spark today, I thought I would take a little bit of a deeper dive into what the draw is to puzzle.
This is great.
You know, maybe obviously some of the deterrents.
I feel like
around
I just
it,
became possessed.
This is great.
I'm so excited. Holy
this is so great. Okay.
No,
so,
this is great because as you talk about this, I'm going to tell you, I've given passing thought to this.
Yes.
Like why I knew that Wes had gone through a hard time and I knew he started puzzling. I was like, that's interesting / curious. And I've also observed other friends who come from backgrounds like the ones you're describing,
yeah,
who are drawn to puzzling. And I'm like, that's interesting, but I've never taken the time that you have taken to talk about and figure out, like, do a little research on why. So
let's dig
give
in.
It to me, baby.
Let's go. All right. So a little bit of history first, because you know I love that. The first known puzzle, jigsaw puzzle, was created in, well, it wouldn't have been jigsaw at the time because there was no jigsaw.
There were not jigs.
No jigs and no saws. But the first known puzzle was created in 1767.
There might have been saws, but no jigs.
Well, there must have been saws.
17.
I want to start this whole paragraph.
No, fuck that.
1767.
Okay, got it.
An Englishman named John Spilsbury.
I love that name.
Spilsbury.
Somebody take the spark of that name and use it as a character name in something
John
that has nothing
Spilsbury.
To do with...
Spilsbury. Yes, please, and then tell us that you used it.
Oh my God, John Spilsbury.
So he was a London engraver and a map maker, and his first jigsaw puzzle was a map of the world. Of course.
Huh.
And he attached a map to a piece of wood, and then he cut out each country. And he, like his kids used it to learn
geography.
And then teachers started using it. And
how smart.
You know, super smart. But puzzles basically stayed the same for the next 100 years. Not
you
a lot
take
of
a picture,
advancement.
You glue it to a piece of wood. You cut
out things out.
Big chunks of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. But then in 1865, we had the ability to create machine-aided, you know, curved lines and stuff. It was called a scroll saw, but eventually would be called a jigsaw. And that tool, obviously, was used to make the puzzles. Still wooden puzzles at that time.
Is it the kind of shapes we know now? Are we moving towards those shapes?
You know, I'm not sure. I don't think yet.
Okay.
I think I'm going to make a guess.
I wonder what those early shapes were, because I don't think it was probably those. When you think of a puzzle piece, like you think Curious George ate a puzzle piece, like you can immediately picture what a modern puzzle piece looks like.
Right.
Remember when Curious George ate a puzzle piece? Do you remember that book? There's a book where Curious George eats a puzzle piece. And I love that. Are you crying?
No.
I love that. She's dabbing her eyes. I thought she
it's
was crying.
Too much.
I loved that book. And when I imagined him eating the puzzle piece, mm-hmm. I had a very visceral feeling about, I loved the way puzzle pieces, especially like for, like think of a puzzle that an elementary school kid would do, like the bigger pieces.
Yeah.
And I imagine when he ate it, it tasted like one of those frosted cookies, like those really frosted, like pretty colorful cookies.
Interesting. Yeah. I doubt it tasted anything like that.
I know, and he probably gave him a tummy ache.
But if it did, I'd have a puzzle piece. I'm feeling now, with my best educated guess, those pieces did not come along until there was die cast, and they, which I'll get to, and they like pressed the the piece shapes down onto the cardboard and cut it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Instead of like a saw cutting through wood.
That's right. This is still like, you still were kind of hand cutting it, but you had the saw could do more. And
I don't
want to
get ahead of it. We can cut all this out. We don't have to get it. Okay.
No, that's totally fine.
We're going to cut everything out of this whole episode.
No, don't cut it.
Like a jigsaw puzzle.
Boo.
On theme.
That won't be the last of it. I'm sad to say there'll be many, many more metaphors. But no, you don't have to cut it because we're back. We're back at 1865. So we have the jigsaw and it is, they're able to do more and more easily with mm-hmm. the aid of this saw, but yeah. it's not.
Does that make puzzles more readily available to people?
A little, but not really in a major way.
We're not in an industrial.
Not yet.
Assembly line puzzle moment. Yeah. Okay.
So by 1880, though, they were machine crafted. And the early 20th century, which is early 1900s, the die cut machines that we were just talking about.
Thank you for saying that, because I have to tell you that I often, when people say mm-hmm. 20th century, I can't remember if you subtract 100 or add 100.
I do the same thing. You have to do the math.
Subtract.
Yeah. You okay. subtract. God. 20th century, 1900s.
Did I mention I have my master's degree?
You smart.
Did I mention it's in acting?
Act your way out of that bag.
Okay, so in the okay. 19...
So early 20th century, which is early 1900s, die-cut machines were able to mass-produce the jigsaw puzzles. Like, they're like printmaking stencils. They were pressed down onto the sheets of cardboard.
I can picture that.
Or like really soft wood, and they would cut that.
Mm. Like balsa wood?
Yeah, it could be. Yeah. And this is around the time that we worked into what's considered the golden age of jigsaw puzzles, which is the 1930s.
I had no idea.
That they had a golden age?
I had no idea.
Oh, yeah. So in the 1930s, it was huge. One, they could be mass produced. Like domestic scenes and railroad trains were popular, and companies used them as marketing tools as well. So they were oftentimes like add-ons, like get a 25-cent puzzle of, you know, your favorite hockey team with the purchase of this shampoo or this toothpaste, you know, so wow. you'd get these little extra.
Some real brand synergy there.
That's right. That's right. You know? They were smart. They were really working it. But anything from like toothbrush or shampoo or whatever could include like a free puzzle or a little bit of an upgrade puzzle.
Wow.
If you can imagine, like the consumer would be so excited. I got this puzzle. This is great. And then the advertiser would be thrilled because the puzzle includes their product.
Sure.
So it's worked in there somewhere. So then there's your product at like an advertisement on the dining room table for a week as the table gets made.
Oh,
or I
wow.
mean, as the puzzle gets made.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So it's kind of genius.
Was a hockey team really one of them?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you made that up.
No, Maple Leaf, a hockey team. I mean, I'm sure there were more than that, but yeah, that was an example that I saw.
Huh. Well, amazing.
Who knew? I probably wouldn't pull out of my butt like a hockey example ever.
I know. I was like, that is a deep cut for you. Can I ask, did you get it?
Yeah.
Was it one of those things where you got it like at the store? If you purchase the shampoo, you get the puzzle, or did you have to mail away and wait 2 months
you know,
to get it?
I don't know. I'm not sure. Because, I mean, it's hard for me to imagine now that they stocked a bunch of puzzles, but I don't really
know.
I'm just making that up.
Wow. So the 30s were rocking it with the puzzles.
30s were rocking it. Also, for this reason, the U.S. was going through the Great Depression. And puzzles, if you think about it, they're a pastime for individuals or for whole families or even groups at parties.
Affordable.
They were relatively inexpensive. They could be done repeatedly. You could do them and then you could share the puzzle with your friend and pass them around. There were even like lending libraries where you could rent a puzzle.
Wait a second.
Yeah.
And then you would, what if somebody returned it and they didn't include all the pieces?
The library counted the pieces when it was returned to make sure that you, Susan, included all the pieces.
Whose job was that?
I don't know.
Sweet Miss Marmalade, the librarian, counting puzzle pieces.
The rental rates could be anywhere from like 3 cents to 10 cents per day. depending on like the complexity of the puzzle and the popularity of the puzzle.
My God, that's so cute. Isn't that sweet? Yes.
So it was interesting because most other commodities were seeing like a downfall in this time, but jigsaw puzzles witnessed a boom. It was crazy. So there's a puzzle historian, Ann Williams, who seems to have cornered the market on puzzle history.
Sure.
I saw her everywhere. And she explained the phenomenon in this way. Puzzles seem to touch a chord, offering an escape from troubled times, as well as the opportunity to succeed in a modest way. Completing a jigsaw gave the puzzler a sense of accomplishment that was hard to come by when the unemployment rates were climbing above 25%. With incomes depleted, home amusements like puzzles replaced outside entertainment like restaurants and nightclubs.
Yes.
Yes.
That's so touching.
It's so touching, yeah, right? To think about like puzzles really brought people together during very hard times.
I remember when we had the recession of 2008 and our household got hit pretty hard by that. And I remember thinking of all the things we could do that we could still be entertained, mm-hmm. that would still be engaging, that cost little to no money.
That's right.
And like, I was like, well, we can go for walks. That would have been a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Puzzles.
You could do puzzles.
Ugh.
And at this time in the 30s, a lot of people were out of work. Carpenters, craftsmen, even architects found themselves suddenly unemployed. And the making of jigsaw puzzles became a way to generate at least a little bit of income.
Wow.
So they would cut jigsaw puzzles and cutting wooden, these were like the heyday of wooden jigsaw puzzles. It kind of became a little cottage industry during the Depression, and local manufacturers, and local people starting their own small businesses to either rent or sell these puzzles.
I don't want to jump ahead if it's going to bust your spark, but is there like a huge market for antique puzzles? Are we going to get there?
Oh, I'm totally, I couldn't miss that one. Yeah.
We're going to
go there.
This is sparks on sparks for
it's
you.
It's sparks on sparks for me because I found a little bit of a thing that made me so excited. I'm going to tell you about in a minute. But so for consumers, because so many people were making puzzles, the prices dropped even more, which was great for them, and made it even more doable. By 1933, jigsaw puzzles were being sold at a rate of 10 million puzzles per week.
What year?
1933.
Heyday. Golden era.
Frickin' believable.
It makes so much sense to me, though, when you say this.
Yeah. So these,
good.
They came up with like a bunch of things like jig of the week, picture puzzle weekly, bewitching weekly, movie cut ups. So they would be tie-ins with movies.
Sure. So if you was loved like I don't know, I'm making up movie star names. Is Lornette Taylor a real movie star? I'm making her up. If you love Lornette Taylor,
you might run out and get that puzzle.
Star of silent movies.
Yes.
You may want her.
That's right.
Her glamour shot from the studio, but as a in puzzle form.
Yeah. Yeah. And you would go out weekly to get your new puzzle.
So instead of like going and getting a magazine of like the stars or whatever, you could get a puzzle and that would be your entertainment for the week.
Yeah, or you might get both because you might get the free puzzle with the magazine. You know what I mean? Or you might get a 5-cent puzzle with the purchase of a magazine.
I have a spark brewing on your spark about puzzles, but you may get there, so go ahead.
Okay, so with these cardboard puzzles becoming popular and sort of flooding the market, the wooden puzzles, like obviously they could not compete, like they couldn't keep their prices at the same price point.
Sure, sure, sure.
So a lot of wooden puzzle manufacturers either converted to like die cut cardboard or they went out of business. But something really remarkable happened. In 1932, two young men, Frank Ware and John Henriquez, they sat down at their kitchen table and they created their first puzzle. And they went into business with the name Par Puzzles. And you may not have heard of Par Puzzles before, but they were and still are known as the Rolls Royce of jigsaw puzzles. So Par Puzzles, so they like kind of flew against the trend in the industry. They hand cut every single puzzle they made. And they produced puzzles for like wealthy industrialists, movie stars, royalty. For example, Dwight D. Eisenhower, the Vanderbilts, the Astors, the Rockefellers, the DuPonts, the Time Magazine publisher Henry Luce and his wife Claire Booth Luce,
yeah,
were both Parr supporters and like made a big to-do like publicly for their love for them. Henry Bogart, Bing Crosby, Yul Brynner, Marlene Dietrich.
Wait, are you saying that they were featured Parr on a puzzle?
No. These were fans of Parr puzzles.
These are fans of the puzzles.
Marilyn Monroe, Gary Cooper, James Garner. The Duke of Windsor loved the puzzle so much. And these, like I said, these are hand done. Every single one of them they're unique. So for the Duke of Windsor, puzzle pieces would be in each one of them, HRH. Would be like His Royal Highness would be cut out somewhere in every single puzzle.
Yes.
For him. All of these people had Par puzzles and they really loved again, if your mind is going to the puzzle pieces that we know of today, wipe the slate clean because these were all handmade.
Wait a second. Each one every was hand cut.
Single puzzle hand cut. I mean, they use the jigsaw, but when you watch it being done, they're literally cutting little shapes in real time.
Oh my gosh.
From the piece of wood. Each piece is a different shape. It's not uniform in any way. So they might, like I said, like they might start with a HRH for him, but then all the other little things, there could be little animals, there could be stars and stripes
so
and all that.
So these weren't, you did not get a Par puzzle when you bought a bottle of shampoo.
Heck no.
These are really expensive puzzles.
These were the other end of the spectrum. So for a lot of people, because
a luxury puzzle.
Well, because like I'm saying, like the other wooden puzzle makers had to go out of business because they couldn't compete with cardboard. So Par just went the other way and said,
they
we're making
niche.
The best of the best.
They went niche. So high end, so luxury.
So niche. So early on.
I did not know luxury puzzles existed.
Oh, yeah.
Until the spark.
Oh, they do.
Wow.
Oh, they do. And they still do. And I'll tell you about that in a second. But early on, they would cut a symbol for the company into each one. That symbol was a swastika. That is because prior to Hitler using that symbol, it is a Hindu character that represents divinity and spirituality.
That's right.
And they used it in their puzzles to represent Par puzzles. As soon as Hitler... You know, they weren't the only ones. Coca-Cola, a lot of people used the symbol. As soon as Hitler appropriated it and decided it was his symbol, they stopped immediately. And
oh my gosh, but if you have one of those puzzles.
Oh my God, could you imagine?
It must be like worth a lot.
Well, I went on eBay to look for Par puzzles and like the least expensive one I saw was like $1,300.
Oh.
Yeah. But anyway, so as soon as Hitler started to use the swastika, they switched to a seahorse. And now there's a seahorse in every Par puzzle.
I love seahorses.
Isn't that
so
super,
much.
Super sweet?
I love that.
So they would often customize, like you might have your birthday initials or the year of your anniversary. Again, those might be like carved into the puzzle, which was really,
so when
really
you,
sweet.
Would you commission these and that's how you would have them customized?
You could. You wow. could. Yeah. You yeah. didn't have to. But yeah. if you didn't.
But if you're Yul Brynner, you could be like, I'll have one and I'll have the head of the king or something.
That's
you know
right.
what I mean?
The other thing that people may not realize is that these puzzles did not come with the image of the puzzle on the box anywhere.
You are shitting me.
I am not. They thought that was cheating. Like, why would you do that? Like,
oh my God.
You need to, you put the puzzle out and you figure out what it is.
So you don't know what the image is that you are building towards.
No. And
this is amazing.
And with Par Puzzles, they perfected the non, like the edges. Like you might think we're going to sit down, we're going to build the
We'll do the frame rectangle first.
Yeah. And no, you won't, because you don't know what the edges look like.
Because the way they cut the edges
That's
are
right.
not.
And they're not regular. So you would it would come in a box.
That's so hard.
And it would just say Par Puzzles. And for Par, they would put on the box what they considered Par times. So it would be a challenge to you. It might be like, this puzzle can be done in 4.5 hours.
It can be done. They would rate how hard the
Par time. Yeah. Wow. Kind of like golf, you know, that's where they got their name, Par. And
you're kidding.
I'm
par
not.
Puzzles.
Yeah. Par puzzles.
Wow.
So that's that, which was really, I thought really cool.
That's very cool. And I wondered, like with Wes, if he ever does not, I mean, I guess when you buy a puzzle now, mostly you see the image on the outside of the box,
That's right.
I wonder if he ever tucks it away and is like, I'm going to try to challenge myself.
Not that I know of, but he could, he might try.
Ooh.
I did find in my research, like the most challenging puzzle now is a clear plastic puzzle that you obviously you don't know
the flip of top and bottom.
That's right. There's no difference between top and bottom. You can see through it.
There's no image.
There's no image. So it's all clear. Yeah. That today in this particular moment is considered the hardest one, but in the history of puzzling around the 1960s, the printing and the die cutting began to like get better and they could do more like fine art reproductions. And at that time in 1965, they printed a Jackson Pollock convergence puzzle, which at that time billed as like the world's most difficult puzzle.
So was it just splatters on splatters?
Yeah. And they sold like thousands upon thousands upon thousands because you're like, I got to try the hardest puzzle in the world.
It's a challenge. But also when you're done, you have a Jackson Pollock.
You have a Jackson Pollock.
And if you Mod Podge it and like frame
that's
it,
right.
then you have a Jackson Pollock.
Guess who has done that in our house? That's right.
Wes will frame that's a puzzle. Right.
So following World War II, the wage scale made like wooden puzzles even more expensive. These other people like Parker Brothers, people stopped making wooden puzzles. It kind of like priced themselves out of like popularity. And Frank Ware, the founder of Par Puzzles, was retiring. And so it seemed like Par Puzzles was coming to an end.
Oh, no.
But guess what I discovered?
What?
They still exist. They still exist. Frank Ware did not have anyone to hand the business to, but he had an apprentice.
Mm-hmm.
And his name was Arthur Gallagher. He took over the business. He had three sons. Those sons were not interested in the business, but he had an apprentice who was a friend of his sons. His name was John Madden. And he took over the business. And he and his son still run it. It's located in Long Island, New York.
You're kidding.
I am not. You can go on parpuzzles.com right now. The puzzles are like 1500 and up because they are one of a kind.
What an amazing gift.
It's incredible. And now, so as you were, it's funny you mentioned like during the recession. So just in terms of history of puzzles, 2008 and 2009, we saw an enormous resurgence again in
puzzles. Affordable
entertainment. Also, people, I think, are looking for an escape from their technology and their screens to get away from their screens for
a
little bit.
Brilliant.
And so in this meantime, some younger people have gotten into the business of bringing back the art form of wooden puzzles. And one
yes,
is a company.
Brooklyn hipsters. Yes.
That's right.
Yes, artisanal
right.
mustaches. Yes.
There is one called Artifact Puzzles. I just found them and I just got Wes a couple of these. They're wooden pieces. You can get a custom picture, but also like the pieces are little custom shapes. They're not all one of a kind though. You can also yes. order from them that are, you know, whatever in stock as they are now,
oh,
but
so
they're
cool.
really cool. And that Wes also was sent on social when he posted, a couple of friends are like, look what I'm doing right now. And they sent like, wooden pieces. I don't know if those were artifact puzzles or not. But
wow. That's so cool.
Yeah. So really, really cool. The woman named, there's a woman named Maya Gupta. She is an electrical engineer and she started Artifact Puzzles. And she said, I was hoping to find an audience that would be a lot like me, people who are technology professionals, but want to get away from the computer.
I love that.
She said she likes jigsaws because they can be assembled neatly in a finite amount of time. By contrast, in her engineering work, the problems are not solvable and things don't ever finish.
So it circles back to that thing that you said originally, which is in challenging times, whether that's because of a depression or recession or because you do work that doesn't solve easily, it's a way for people to have that sense of, I don't remember the exact words you used, but that sense of gratification from neatly, completely solving something.
Yes. And the frankly, dopamine gets released like
every time. I was
going to
say, do you know what the chemicals are?
Yeah. Well, every that one I know.
So
yeah.
Every time a puzzle piece clicks into place, an angel gets a hit of dopamine.
Yeah, that's a phrase.
There
yeah.
you go.
That's a saying.
I love that.
Yeah, but that is true.
Yeah.
But you're spot on.
Which makes it a nice alternative to things like your cell phone, your iPad, social
yes.
media, because instead of waiting for the dopamine hit to come from, oh, I got the
Someone
little red
else.
Dot that somebody
yeah.
messaged me or somebody liked a thing I posted, it could be the satisfaction of you putting a puzzle in order.
That's right.
Nice.
That's right. There's, in terms of like, the timeline of puzzles, I almost don't even want to mention this because I don't know how I feel. I'm dubious. But like there are now apps that, you know, you can do to like put puzzle pieces
put it back
together.
On your phone. Yeah, yeah.
And then I'm like, I don't see, I want to say it just so I know I recognize that is true, but I'm dubious. I'm not sure that you get the same benefits that we're talking about. And
there's something about the feel of it goes back to my Curious George.
Yeah.
There's something about the feeling of a puzzle piece
yep.
and the way it's a little like shinier on the top and the way the edges are a little bit curved. That is too satisfying.
All of it.
Yeah.
All of it. So I wanted to touch base just a little bit more with, you know, experts' points of view on why puzzling is so satisfying. And there have been a number of studies, including the MacArthur study, that have shown that keeping the mind active with jigsaw puzzles and other like mind flexing activities can actually lead to longer life expectancy, a better quality of life, a reduction of chances of developing certain types of mental illness, including memory loss, dementia, and even Alzheimer's disease. That gets cut by a third, which is pretty amazing.
A third is so many.
A third is so many. It is. Oh my God.
A third is a lot.
I thought you were teasing me.
No, a third is a lot.
Like it is a lot.
33%.
It's amazing.
It cuts down on Alzheimer's.
It's amazing.
33%. No. That's news you
That's
can use.
That's news you can use.
This is great.
So it makes us alert. It increases our concentration. It expands our creativity. So I have a little list of things that I wanted to share. Just, you know, the results of all of these tests.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that the biggest takeaway is like the simplicity of them is really deceptive. Your brain is working on so many levels. For example, so what most of these studies talk about, as most of us know, the brain has two separate hemispheres, the left and the right brain, and the right brain deals with emotions and performs tasks like holistically, and the left brain functions in a more linear fashion. Mm. So the left brain, our analytical side, sees all of these separate pieces and attempts to sort them out logically. The right brain, our creative side, is seeing the big picture and working more intuitively. Mm-hmm. And in this process, your brain cells, you're actually making connections between brain cells. You know, we always love this like neuroscience and how to strengthen the pathways in our brain. And as it turns out, like jigsaw puzzles are helping you do that, like helping increase your ability to learn, to comprehend, to remember. And like we just mentioned, like encourage the production of dopamine and brain chemicals that increase your learning and your memory and your happiness, frankly. So overall, they induce this state of creative focused meditation where connections can be made on deeper.
Creative focused meditation. Come on.
Creative meditation is the phrase I kept coming back to in this research. Creative meditation.
You know how I'm always searching for the phrase that describes the feeling that you get when you're in the midst of making something and you're like, you have this sense of satisfaction.
That's right.
Creative meditation comes the closest of anything I've ever heard.
I thought so too, because previously flow state was the state like people would talk about it. And I'm like, it is flow, but it feels like it's more than that.
Yeah.
And to me, creative meditation got a little bit closer to it.
Yeah.
But so just to get into the specifics, they have identified a number of thought processes that are required to undertake this complex process of identifying shapes and images and relating them to an overall pattern. So the benefits include problem-solving skills. I think that's, pretty self-explanatory. It enhances self-evaluation, like trying to see how pieces fit and reassess where they might go, how they relate to each other. If they don't fit this way, they might fit another way. Mm. It's like having your brain constantly reevaluate decisions and teaching patience at the same time. It improves learning abilities. You get better at recognizing shape, slight color differences, just basic like learning structures. It's amazing. It helps with overall perception and understanding. Often like only a certain amount of information about a situation is available when you have to make a decision.
Yeah. Sometimes you're just looking at the clear puzzle.
That's it, right?
You don't know what's up and what's down.
That's right.
Yeah.
Or all you know is it's got a little bump right here in the piece, but I don't know what the rest of it looks like. So I know I'm looking for this one thing.
Yeah.
Fulfillment. Yeah. So that piece that we've talked about. Mm-hmm. And the dementia treatment.
Oh, amazing.
So a couple of things I will leave you with. There's a woman on YouTube named Karen Puzzles. I enjoy her very much.
I wish that was her real last name.
Karen Puzzles. But she says doing puzzles makes me feel like I'm healing the parts of my brain that the internet has rotted. I look for a piece I need. I find the piece I need.
Amazing.
Right?
I know.
The very first puzzles were used to teach children geography. And some might say that 250 years later, puzzles are still good for helping people find their way.
Oh,
come on.
That's wonderful.
And I'll just leave you with this. When PAR puzzles originally chose the swastika to use as their symbol, one interpretation of the symbol is well-being. Mm. And I just think that seems symbolically like a very, very good choice. Puzzle making.
I love that. And I'm so mad at Hitler for ruining that for all of us.
I know.
Who knew that the spark would end
good
with,
one.
Fuck you, Hitler.
Fuck you, Hitler.
That is so great,
That's
Cams.
It.
I have so many sparks
oh,
off
good.
Of your spark.
Good. I want to hear.
I feel like we are due for a puzzle renaissance.
We are.
You know how like a lot of people were doing like that therapeutic coloring books for adults.
That's right.
This could be... So if you're an inventor, if you're like a marketer, if you're somebody, yeah. Here's my proposal for you. Like, there's something about this, like, meditative, therapeutic puzzling that I think is due for a renaissance. I think there could be tie-ins, like Yieldy Times tie-ins with other products, potentially. One thing that I have observed in myself, and it makes me want to, this whole thing makes me want to get out a puzzle.
I know,
and
me give it a swing, too, right?
Is when I am doing a puzzle with someone, I have the best conversations.
Oh my God.
There's something
yes.
about the activity of the brain, the eyes, and the hands are doing a puzzle, and the conversations that flow out over the top of it are so good.
Yes.
So that sparks me to want to do a puzzle. And what else did I have other ones? Oh, I wondered if there were, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, I feel like when you have reached a creative challenge, whether it's like, I can't figure out this thing in my script,
yes,
what does this show need, what's missing, let your subconscious work that stuff out while you're focusing
over
on a puzzle. Because it will. It really will.
I think that's really smart.
Yeah.
I think that's super, super smart. This makes me want to puzzle. The other question that I have is, I wonder in your research, or if you know, are there puzzles for the blind?
I don't know. That's a really, really, really good question. I'm going to find that out.
I think that would be, I think all of these benefits would be useful. I have to believe there are. But if there's
imagine.
Not, and if you're listening to this and you're sparked by puzzle making or accessibility, I love the idea of puzzles for the blind.
That would be amazing.
Good spark.
Yes. Okay.
I'm inspired to do a puzzle.
I'm so happy that you are.
And
I'm inspired too.
I'm psyched because I think your spark ties into my spark.
Oh, really?
Lightly.
Oh, I can't wait.
Lightly.
Yes.
Back in a minute.
Woo.
The spark.
I love that spark.
Oh.
Oh my gosh. And there are some little light tie-ins to mine.
Oh, good. I can't wait. Okay. I'm excited.
The title of my spark is, we're all just walking each other home. Sparks from the Spark were provided by a book by Katie Butler, a website called endoflifeinspirations.com, thresholdchoir.org, and pottermore.com. And here's a little content warning / trigger warning, aka CW / TW, aka CW / TWs. In the Spark, we are going to be talking about death and medical conditions, as you know I love to do. So cami in, be forewarned, listeners. Be forewarned.
Where's the tissue?
Exactly. So my spark all started with something called the Ars Moriendi. Years and years, do you know that term, Ars
Mm-mm.
Moriendi? Years Mm-mm. ago, I initiated this project with my collaborators, Hunter Bell, Jeff Bowen, Heidi Blickenstaff, Larry Presgrove, and Michael Barres, tip of the hat. And we made this off-Broadway musical called Now Hear This. And it's just this tight 90-minute existential musical comedy now available for licensing via Rodgers and Hammerstein. Anyway, so we're writing this little existential musical comedy. It's about life and death and aspiring to be present. And Hunter Bell and I were doing research on this number that we wrote called Penny Words. Penny Words is this light little bonbon about end of life and palliative care and hospice. And it was sparked by this amazing New Yorker article written by an author I love named Atul Gawande. And if you want to hear that piece, you can find it on my website, susanblackwell.com. Anyway, In researching that piece, and I swear we're going to get to the inside of this Russian doll, we came across this thing called the Ars Moriendi, and it's a 15th century Latin guide to the art of dying that was reprinted in more than 100 editions across Europe. It was an incredibly
Whoa.
Popular book by some unknown monk. So this little thing that I'm about to This quote, long quote I'm about to read to you, is from this wonderful writing by a woman named Katie Butler. I'm going to talk more about Katie in a second, but these are her words. In the mid-1400s, when the Black Death was still fresh in the cultural memory, an unnamed Catholic monk wrote a medieval death manual called Ars Moriendi, or The Art of Dying. Written in Latin and illustrated with woodcuts, it taught the dying and those who loved them how to navigate the physical and spiritual trials of the deathbed. One of the West's first self-help books, it went through 65 editions before 1500, and it was translated into all the major languages of
God.
Europe. So that's the Ars Moriendi.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And it was filled with these woodcuts. And Katie Butler says in each woodcut, you can see illustrations of a dying man or a woman lying in bed, attended by friends and their spouses and angels, and sometimes a doctor or a servant or a favorite hound. And the soul pictured in these woodcuts is a tiny version of the human being, and it would leave the body and fly to heaven in the company of an army of angels. Sometimes a roof tile would be loosened to ease the escape of the soul. Wow. And then in the same woodcut beneath the bed are demons, and they're urging the ill person to give in to one of the five, what they called temptations, standing in the way of their dying. And those temptations were lack of faith, despair, impatience, spiritual pride, and avarice, which is not wanting to say goodbye to things and people of this world.
Can you say those five one more time?
Yes. Yes, I can. Here we go. More band names.
Yeah.
Lack of faith, despair, impatience, spiritual pride, and avarice.
Wow.
Right? So we don't necessarily call them temptations anymore, but these emotions, fear, remorse, wanting to die quickly, and not wanting to die at all, are all familiar to most who have sat at a deathbed or in a deathbed.
And according to that book, those would be the ways that the devil and the demons would try to get
impede
you to
your just like a clean death or an easy death, or a satisfying death. So the antidote, counseled the Ars Moriendi, was not to fight bodily death by medical means, but to really care for the soul. And Katie goes on to say, in the Ars Moriendi, the dying were not passive patients, but the lead actors in their lives' final, most important drama. Even on their deathbed, even in pain, they had choices and moral agency, which I love. So that's a little bit about the Ars Moriendi, the art of dying. Yeah. So after Hunter Bell and I wrote this Penny Words piece, which the piece that we wrote explores the end of life of his grandmother and Heidi Blickenstaff's grandmother, and Hunter and Heidi's presence during their grandmother's end of life years. After we wrote and performed all that, then Hunter Bell's mom passed away rather suddenly. And for the first time, I found myself sitting at someone's bedside at their end of life. And I've got to tell you, it was a profound experience. It was sad at times. It was scary at times, but I also found it, if I'm honest, incredibly life-affirming and really brain-changing. Believe it or not, it was chock-a-block with sparks.
I believe it.
So as you know, Cams, pretty much everything that I do in the world is to try to make sense of the world. And I really wanted to make sense of that experience. So I wrote this story called Linda Bell, featuring original music by Larry Presgrove. And it was directed by Jessica Stone and Bob Hetherington. And I performed it at Story Gathering in 2018. You can see that little jim jam on my website too, SusanBlackwell.com. I swear this isn't just an advertisement for my website. So in that piece, I share this anecdote about sitting vigil at that hospice and how my mind traveled back in time to my first acting class in college. I had this drama teacher who had us do this exercise where all of us acting students were zipping around the acting studio like a bunch of hummingbirds. And then he would say, pause, and we'd all stop. We'd just freeze and kind of hover wherever we were. And then our teacher said this: the greatest artists are those who are willing to contemplate their own mortality. There are not endless days spooling out in front of you. With this in mind, I want you to ask yourself, how do I want to live this life? Unpause. And then off we'd go. So I've never forgotten that moment. And it was in a class that I had with a teacher named Mark Olson. And I didn't understand it for a long time, but now I'm feeling like I'm starting to understand it. Mm-hmm. So I wrote that piece, Linda Bell, because I felt changed by being in the presence of end of life. And it was a total ass rocker. It was a brain changer. It reminded me so much of that great metaphor that J.K. Rowling created in the Harry Potter books from the Pottermore website. Thestrals are those black skeletal bat-winged horses invisible to all who have never been truly touched by death. Being able to see thestrals is a sign that the beholder has witnessed death and gained an emotional understanding of what death means. I have always thought that was an amazing spark that Joe Rowling had with that thestral idea. I just love that metaphor so much. I don't know if you're a fan of those books or movies, but
yeah,
I was like, yeah. I just thought it's it was genius.
Incredible. Yeah.
Because I do think if you have been in the presence of death or you have not been in the presence of death, you do have potentially a different understanding of things.
I totally agree.
So then I ran into this book by Katie Butler, the aforementioned Katie Butler, called The Art of Dying Well. She was the one who wrote all those words I just read about the Ars Moriendi.
And she wrote them a long time ago, right?
No. This book just came out.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Got it.
So Katie Butler's book is a cornucopia of sparks. There are sparks shooting out of this book in so many different directions. And so we're only going to scratch the surface. This book, and it is not a big book, is so well researched. It is so well written. It is so poetic while at the same time being so practical and so useful. And I cannot recommend it highly enough. The Art of Dying Well by Katie Butler. So Katie's initial spark to write the book came when her dad at 79 had this devastating stroke. And then 2 years later, her father was given a pacemaker to correct a slow heartbeat. In her words, this tiny electronic device made him, as he put it, live too long by forcing his heart to outlive his brain. He spent the next 6.5 years dependent on my exhausted mother, descending step by step into deafness, near blindness, dementia, and misery. Close to the end, my mother and I embarked on a modern rite of passage, asking his doctors to deactivate a medical technology capable of preventing his death without restoring him to a decent life. His doctors refused. Mm-mm. It is so that was her spark, like wanting to write this book came out of
feelings.
Yes.
I have feelings
too, as somebody who is aging and also somebody who loves aging parents, like, and aging friends.
Yeah.
This book really made me re-examine all of it.
It I feel angry when this topic comes up because...
Are you mad at me now?
I'm so mad at you. We're not talking. I feel angry when this topic comes up because it's one of the most important things I think that you can consider, you know, the aspects of it that are within your control.
Yeah.
And that we don't live in a world where we can have very much control of it. It feels frustrating.
Do you mean the current, like the
medical
treatment?
Situation.
Like,
yeah.
I think if you read this book, you're going to feel like you have more control agency than you may have thought previously.
Good.
I can't quote her because I don't have the book sitting next to me. It's on my desk. But she says, like, doctors are consultants. They are basically, she's sort of like, just because they say, I recommend that you immediately begin radiation and chemo or have this thing implanted in you or whatever, it doesn't mean you have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You have more choice than you think you have what one of the many things that I took away from this book. She writes, there is a way to a peaceful, empowered human death, even in an era of high technology medicine. It begins long before the final panic trip to the emergency room. It requires navigating over years, not days. I fucking love this book. She went on to say, in the years I've spent listening to hundreds of people's stories of good and difficult declines and deaths, I've learned one thing. People who are willing to contemplate their aging, vulnerability, and mortality often live better lives in old age and illness and experience better deaths than those who don't. It's like my movement teacher said, I'm coming to believe that artists and people who are willing to think and talk and make about these things might live better lives and experience better deaths than those who don't.
That's right.
Yeah. So she then devotes a chapter to each stage of life from kind of where I am now until you are actively dying. And she teases, it's so brilliant. The way that this book is organized is so good. She teases up each chapter so that you can easily identify where you are in life and what would be helpful for you to read mm-hmm. at that life stage. Mm-hmm. But this book, I don't think this book is just for the oldies. I think there are sparks for everyone in there. And Katie Butler also reads the audiobook, which is so good. Her reading of her own book,
it is really good.
I enjoy listening to you, Katie Butler. I'm sure you're not listening to this. So I would say that I'm going to take you along for this ride too. You may hear my dogs barking in the background. That's not a metaphor. It's not my feet. My dogs are actually barking in the background. So I would say that you and I are both firmly in chapter one, which is resilience. We both easily blew out the candles on my 50th birthday cake. We have aches and pains, but they're just annoying. They're not limiting. It's harder for me to read the fine print on the back of credit cards. I sometimes sense that my time on earth is limited and precious. I still have the physical capacity to reverse substantial health problems. And then she provides some really straightforward action steps, things that require the most of the reader and the least of medicine, like walking energetically for 30 minutes every day, which I think is something you already do.
I try.
I need to do that. A big one, and this is a big one for both of us and for many people listening, is guarding your brain, as it is the keystone of continued independence and freedom. And you know, Camion, how I loves my freedom.
Wow.
And just really specific things you can do. Befriending the neighbors and younger people for a couple of reasons. Loneliness is a health risk. Meaningful social engagement is great for the brain. And these folks can be of support. You know, we can all mm-hmm. be of support to each other. Mm-hmm. So here's where I'm at right now. I am going to start kind of building a more conscious group of people mm-hmm. who I want to invite into like social engagement and who want to be part of a support network. And it also reminded me of this spark that my friend Robert Frost gave me. Robert Frost, the musician, not the poet, the road less traveled. I am such a sequestered introvert. And he suggested that I host a kind of like a monthly open house or potluck so that anybody who's available to come and wants to come can come. And I just make like a big pot of chili or a big lasagna or a big pizza party. And just to bolster that social engagement.
That is huge.
Yeah.
That is huge.
But this is what I'm talking about. It makes life better now.
Yes.
And nobody needs to know that I'm actually plotting how you all are going to care for me and my dotage. Anyway.
We will all be there. Don't you worry.
Will you?
Yes.
We talk a lot about making that work we love with people we love. Mm-hmm. We talk about that a lot. This book has sparked my thoughts I have been dying. Terrible. Aww. To talk to you about this, Camion. This book has sparked my thoughts about creating a life and a future that we love and beginning to actively envision that now. So in our creative workshops, we encourage people's awareness that they can create something where nothing existed before. Like you can make a book, a musical, a quilt, a poem. Mm-hmm. But this book has expanded my thinking. I want to consciously begin building the next chapters of my life now. So I'm taking a long view, but I think there are ways to start doing that now. So here are some sparks that I want to fan.
Yes. I'm excited.
Some of these you're going to be like, dry. And some of these you're going to be like, hooray, a pizza party. But I want to create a durable power of attorney for healthcare. This is a legal instrument that appoints a medical decision maker to speak for me if I can't speak for myself. But Katie's really specific. She says the ideal person lives nearby, knows what matters to you, is willing to assert it, is willing to drop everything in an emergency, gets along with people, and has a strong backbone.
Wow.
So that's real specific.
That's real specific.
And it starts to weed out.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
That's right.
Want to make a living will, which is a document that covers moral and medical dilemmas that arise if you're comatose, close to death, or unlikely to recover. I think in my mind, when I was like, get your paperwork in order, I kind of just made them all one thing.
Yeah.
But there's different things you want to get
there
in order.
Are. Yep.
So with this living will, it sounds like they're pretty boilerplate, but you can amend yours to serve as a guide for your medical advocate in case you can't communicate with them.
Yeah.
Something that I actually did was I got this slim little thingy. It's called Five Wishes. You can order them online from agingwithdignity.org, and you just fill in the blanks and circle. They make it so easy, and you basically describe your vision of a good death. So it's stuff like, I want to be kept fresh and clean at all times. I want my lips and mouth to be kept moist to stop dryness. I wish to be forgiven for times I have hurt my family. I wish that my memorial service to include the following. Honestly, it took me like, I put it off forever because I was like, that thing's going to be daunting. And when I finally cracked it open, it took me about 10 minutes to complete it because they've made it so easy. We had some friends over. I signed it. They witnessed it. It's tucked in my file cabinet. I let my husband know where it is. My sister and my mom know, and now you know too, Cam.
Oh my gosh.
And listeners, you all know too. It's in the top drawer of my desk filing cabinet. It's in a red folder. It's the only thing in a red folder, and it says ICE in case of emergency. Okay. So that's where it is.
Wow.
I still need to get those other things in order though. But the great thing about this book is it gives you very actionable ways to live well so that you can prepare to die well. But I actually think it's a list of sparks so that you can just live well.
Yeah.
It's things like getting your paperwork in order and making your end of your wishes known, but it's also stuff like the aforementioned, getting 30 minutes of vigorous, pleasurable exercise every day, cultivating friendships with younger people, helping friends who are sick, and finding ways to mentor and give. Create a simple daily spiritual practice, including 30 minutes of quiet time and a gratitude list to feed your soul, which I do, but I could do more of.
Yes.
Consider making the contemplation of death a part of your spiritual practice, as do many wisdom traditions. It won't make you die any sooner. And it may help you appreciate your life today more keenly. I think that some people have bought into a story that if they meditate on end of life, that they're going to bring about their death. And I think it is a crock of shit.
Yeah, I think it's crock. It's come up a few times when we're talking with people and we'll often ask, like, what do you need to do before you're done?
Yeah.
And it does sometimes hit a nerve of like, oh, if I say this, does that mean I'm
going to
bring this about?
That's right.
Sooner?
Yeah. That's right. They think it's a jinkies or something.
And what I'm finding is weird, what I'm thinking about is how like people will oftentimes worry unnecessarily about things that have not happened yet or may not ever happen. And the feeling is, if I worry about this, maybe I'll keep it at bay. And then when it comes to death, the reverse is true of like, if I don't think about it, don't talk about it, don't plan
for it. If I can't see it, it can't see me.
That's right.
Yes.
Then I can keep it at bay.
Yeah.
How fascinating.
Yeah. Something that I found, this is very specific, but I think it's really interesting and truly news you can use. There's a group of drugs known as, I'm going to say this wrong, anticholinergics. They're commonly prescribed and in some over-the-counter medicines like Benadryl. They substantially increase the likelihood of developing dementia. I'm not a doctor, so please consult a real doctor, but I checked all my meds to make sure that I was avoiding anticholinergics because they have such a tight link to dementia.
Whoa.
And CAMS, I would like you to do the same.
I'm going to do the same. Thank you for that.
On a completely different tip, older people who've learned to treat other people decently, no matter what their social status, will have an easier time navigating this drastic psychic reorganization when you're aging and you need to rely on people. So there's another spark and another practice. And it goes to my, you know, one of my favorite sayings in the world is, no one is above me, no one is below me, haters to the left. I'm psyched because I'm living that way now. And I think it's a practice that will set me up as I age. I've seen people who like treat for instance, like treat waiters poorly. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that look is not going to be cute. Mm-mm. When you really need somebody to change your bedpan.
That's right.
So like, that's get it right. together.
Yep.
But also I feel like that nobody's above me. Nobody's below me. Haters to the left. Also, as you move through the world, you do have more meaningful social engagement. And I think that I'm not a researcher, but I think that probably increases your chance of having a community of people mm-hmm. that would show up when you need support.
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely.
Do you want to say, was there something you want to say?
It's amazing. I'm just taking it.
Is it making you introspective? I can see it on your face.
It is. I'm thinking about my mom's death. I'm thinking about all the things I learned from that and the things that I've prepared for so far and what else I need to do. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
It's all happening.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what this
sparks.
Book is for. Yeah.
Another spark. In her book, Katie Butler recounts the work of an Israeli psychologist named Valery Hazanov, who during his training at Columbia University learned much from the people he worked with in New York City nursing homes. Those who did best were creatures of habit, and this is from Katie's book. One 94-year-old woman whom he admired woke at 6:30 a.m. and first made her bed. Then she went for a stroll with her walker, ate breakfast, exercised in the rehab room, read, ate lunch, napped, went for another walk, drank tea with a friend, ate dinner, and went to bed. Her disciplined routines gave her life structure. She pushes herself to do things, some of which are very difficult for her, without asking herself why it is important to do them. Hazanov wrote this in Vox.com. Mm-hmm. I think that is what keeps her alive. Her movement, her pushing, is her life. Observing her, I have been coming to the conclusion that it might be true for all of us.
Oof.
And this spark spoke to me for freelancers, for artists, for people who work from home, for those who create their own structure, and those who aspire to be more engaged with their creativity. We have a saying around the Spark File, and that is doing things means doing things. I guess it's more of a jingle than a saying. But you create that structure, you commit to it, you keep it up, you do the work. While creativity may contain magical elements within it, it is not magic. It's step by step, it's day by day. That is how things get made. Those are the foundations of a writing practice or a movement practice or a making practice or a living practice, just like that.
Practice.
Just like that 94-year-old in that nursing home.
It's true.
I was so sparked by that.
And I'm thinking now, like when we're just talking about puzzling and how it has a bit of a bad name, like it's a grandma thing. I think that routines have a bit of a bad name as well.
Like, I think you're right.
Like, oh, if I'm creative, I'm just constantly like, I'm responding to my feeling in the moment and the whims and the where the day takes me
and the blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. And all of that, obviously being in the moment, all of that is important as well. But at the expense of what could be so good for you, routine to like show up.
Yeah.
Every day at the same time and say, I'm ready.
And do it because you committed to doing it.
That's right.
I feel like we hear that again and again with makers who are really, really get a lot done. They are at the desk. They're at the easel. They are very disciplined about that.
That's right.
Yeah. In addition to sharing very practical research and anecdotally supported advice about real nuts and bolts medical things, Katie Butler also addresses the human spirit. This is why I love this book. It's like, here's exactly the paperwork you need to get in order. Here's how to do it. Here's what you need to do in terms of diet and exercise. Or even like a spiritual practice. But so she talks in the book about people receiving terminal diagnoses and then asking how they want to live out the time that they have left. And I just thought, what if we became aware of our mortality now? Mm. And instead of that becoming scary or macabre, could that awareness be life-affirming, like my acting teacher alluded to? What if my willingness to contemplate my own mortality brought me more life and more creativity? Right?
Yes.
So for example, they talk about people who are given a terminal diagnosis and then decide to go on an adventure or finish a big creative project that they've always wanted to make, or resolve an outstanding conflict, or to make amends with someone, or make sure that their loved ones are set up financially. And I just thought, while keeping my commitments to my loved ones and my work and my financial commitments, I just want to examine how I can do all of that stuff now. I don't want to wait until somebody hands me the expiration date. Do you know what I mean?
Oh God, I do.
No matter how close your mortality feels right now, I'm asking myself the question. I invite you to ask yourself the question, what is something I could do today that I would really enjoy?
Mm.
What is something that I want to make before I go? And I want you all to listen to the answers to those questions, because I think it could be some real sparks. Another spark related to this that I've been trying to rock actively in the world, in the words of John Mayer, is say what you need to say and say it now.
Yes.
So I've been trying to actively tell people, small things and large, that I want them to know now. And I'm going to give you an example. This is on point for this spark. After my divorce, when I was getting my body back into shape and trying to get my life back into shape and trying to gain self-confidence again, and maybe even one day start dating again, I had a trainer named Landon Jones, and I can't tell you, I would work out at like 5:30 or 6 o'clock in the morning every day. And I was weightlifting for the first time in my life. I had never been older, and I had never exercised. I'd never lifted weights. I'd never exercised harder. And I've just found this trainer that I loved named Landon Jones. And I spent a lot of time with him, real formative time, getting stronger, feeling healthier. And he was he's a love and a guide for that. And a few months back, it's actually been about a year now, Landon was assisting somebody on the side of a very busy highway, and he was killed suddenly in a very strange accident. And I was devastated. And when I got the news, I remember literally, it was like a movie, literally my knees buckling and having to sit down. And it was terrible, but a comfort that I take away from that is almost immediately I remembered that before he actually left the gym where we worked out, before he had left, I had said, before you leave, because I don't know when I'm going to see you again, I need to say some things to you. And he sort of got very bashful and looked down, and I squared his shoulders so we were face to face, and I kind of lifted up his head so we were looking in each other's eyes, and I told him how much of a difference he had made in my life during a very, very challenging time. And in his passing, I was comforted. I was truly comforted that past me had the wherewithal to take the time to have said what I needed to say to him, and that he hopefully knew and carried with him in his heart that I loved him and was so, that he had changed my life, that he had really changed my life as he had walked next to me through this, as I trudged over Divorce Mountain, he had been hiking next to me. Wow. And I got to tell him that. So that's a spark I'd like to share, which is, why wait? Yes. Say what you need to say now. Another spark, this is where you come in, Cams. Oh. Another spark that I'm formulating is about creating a communal living situation as we get older. I don't have children. You don't have children. Many of our friends don't, but I do have this chosen family of close friends. And I'm just starting to think about,
yes,
let's pick a really cool, convenient neighborhood in a really cool, interesting city. I don't know where it's going to be. Maybe someplace warmer. Maybe not. I don't know. Austin, Portland. I don't know. Someplace that has great healthcare and walkable shops and restaurants and doctor's office. And let's find a great, either a single level house or an apartment building with a doorman and an elevator and great balconies, and let's live near each other and support each other and wipe each other's butts if necessary.
I was waiting for that. Is that where we're headed?
Yeah. In her book, Katie refers to a TED Talk given by an EMT named Matthew O'Reilly. Great TED Talk, Matthew O'Reilly. In his work as an EMT, he has attended many people dying on the side of the highways after automobile accidents. And he says most people have three pieces of unfinished business.
Oof.
And they are, they have regrets and they want to be forgiven. They fear they'll be forgotten and hope they'll be remembered. And they want to know that their lives had meaning.
Ugh.
And Katie goes on to say, ask yourself, what stands in the way right now of your dying in peace? What do you regret? What do you fear? Do you feel that your life has meaning? And Cams has lost it.
I really thought, like, okay, I'm going to get through this conversation, okay? But that, yeah, that one got me.
What's happened? What does it bring up for you?
One, I want to ask myself that question, of course, and clear up anything.
They're good questions.
But I think about, you know, everything from, you know, I'm just trying to matter, that concept of, you know, people having spent time on this earth and wanting to make sure that it was purposeful.
Yes.
And I forget what I was watching recently where it was back in the old timey days, but the threat was, we're going to wipe out like all memory of you, all recollection, like your name being wiped from the history books.
Was it Coco? Were you watching Coco? Coco has
Does it have that theme?
Yeah, it's beautiful.
So that theme recently, it feels like it's come up a little bit. And even at Story, we're talking like someone, the last person to say your name. Does that ring a bell for you? Yeah.
Can you say more about it? So the people that weren't there?
Yes. I was like, was that at Story? I couldn't remember.
I think it was.
So there, a person dies two deaths. One is when they actually die. And the second death is when the last time that someone says their name.
This is very Coco, the animated feature Coco.
I've never seen it, but I need to.
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful movie. And Bobby and Kristen Lopez get that Academy Award. And there are little Chihuahua dogs in it, which you know I loved.
I mean, so it's got everything.
It's got it all.
It's got everything.
Death, dying, Chihuahua dogs.
Oh my gosh.
This movie's got everything.
But that concept of being wiped from history, I think is painful to some who have this fear of being forgotten.
Yeah.
So yeah, you got me with that.
I gotcha.
You got
me say this. What if we can ask ourselves these questions and act on these answers well before we are nearing death? What if those answers are sparks for us to take action, like action in our lives, action in our creative work, action in our personal and collaborative relationships, action in our fight for social justice, action in our service work.
I did go to church today.
Yes. So
this is awesome.
Here's more questions for you. I'm just peppering you with questions.
Okay.
Ask yourself, listeners, Susan, Laura, what practicalities need to be addressed? Is there an area of your life you'd like to get in order? Do you have a story you'd like to tell? Do you have something you'd like to say? Do you have someone you'd like to thank? Do you have someone you'd like to forgive? These are good questions. Katie Butler talks about the work of a pioneering hospice doctor named Ira Bayak, who, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing that, who summed up the five emotional tasks to be completed near the end of life in these words. These are amazing words. Please forgive me. I forgive you. Thank you. I love you. Goodbye. And she's gone. Cams, I'm sorry.
It's good. It's good.
Here's one more for you. A hospice nurse named Red Wing Kesar is quoted as saying, people die as they lived. I believe that. I do believe people. Another thing that they said, Landon Jones used to say to me, is the way you do something is the way you do everything.
Oof.
People die as they lived. And I want to practice these things now so that when I'm nearing end of life, whether that's tonight or 40 years from tonight, I will have really made a practice of living creatively and cleanly and being kind to people in all areas of my life.
And built a community.
Yeah, cleaning as I go, asking for forgiveness, forgiving people, making the things I want to make so that they're in the world, which also goes to legacy, right? Another spark. In the book, there's the story of this amazing woman named Loretta Downs. Her mother was dying in a nursing home in 2006, and Loretta got permission to transform an unused storage room into a private, sacred space, which she decorated with her mother's possessions. There were flowers and pictures of her mom's cats, like taped up on the wall. Friends and family came to share their memories. They brought food. Other residents of the nursing home stopped by to say goodbye. Loretta Downs, this amazing woman, was an experienced hospice volunteer with a professional background in interior design, and she named the space she created the Chrysalis Room after the pupa that holds the caterpillar as it is transformed into a butterfly. Cams is full on sobbing into her kimono. sobbing. So she named it the Chrysalis Room, and this room became a permanent and beloved feature of the nursing home where her mother lived and died, and set into motion a cultural shift. Before the room was arranged, nursing home staff feared death, and they sent most dying residents to the hospital. After the Chrysalis Room opened, more residents died in the place that had become their home rather than in the hospital. Other residents became more likely to participate in the final goodbyes, and some became less fearful of their own deaths. Loretta Downs has since helped create Chrysalis Rooms in nursing homes and other places, and she says with a little imagination, almost any private space can be made more humane than a shared room. Her website, endoflifeinspirations.com, has information on how to improvise or build a Chrysalis Room.
Wow.
And I was like, what a beautiful spark of creativity that she wanted to... Her website is really... I mean... You have to have seen a Thestral or be comfortable with being in the presence of death, I think, to explore some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
I am. I feel, mm-hmm. I mean, things still scare me, but I am, I don't know. I'm just into like being brave and talking about all of this super openly because I want to have from this moment to the end of my life be as, I don't know, just as wonderful and as creative as possible, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
And at peace with this, like it, not have it be something that you've put in a compartment that you're trying not to look into.
I think about it every day. It is built into my meditation practice. If you do go and look at that piece that I wrote, Linda Bell, which is on my website, SusanBlackwell.com, you'll see that I had a realization sitting at Hunter Bell's mom's bedside, which is, I meditate for about an hour a day, and I had a realization meditating with holding Linda's hand while she was on her deathbed. And that is, I do believe that meditation is preparation for dying. Mm. I really do believe it is. It's preparation to pass to a different dimension. So... The book mentions, and then I took a deeper dive into this side spark called the Threshold Choir. Their motto is kindness made audible, which I love. The Threshold Choir was started by a woman named Kate Munger who was volunteering with AIDS patients. And when Kate would get scared or nervous, she would start singing. And she watched her patients get calm and settled and serene when she sang. Which I thought was so beautiful. It's like when you're walking through a forest and you get scared, you can sing to yourself. Oh. Or I always love that metaphor. In a video on the Threshold Choir's website, a hospice patient is interviewed and he says how the Threshold Choir singing by his bedside helps relieve some of his physical pain and makes him smile. The 36-year-old man in that video who is laying in the hospice bed with a brain tumor says, I believe that our purpose as human beings is to be givers, however we can. We go through the hardships of life. We go through the beauty of life. We take all the energy and find a way to give and help others. When they come to sing, it is an act of love and support, which is what I need most in my life right now. And here I go. There's a lyric that I love in one of the songs by the Threshold Singers. The lyrics are a quote from Ram Dass, and that quote is, we are all just walking each other home. I love it so much. And it's what I titled my spark today. We are all just walking each other home. So when I think about my future and, you know, end of life, I think, is there a way that we can bring our lives closer to each other so that we can truly walk each other home? And it actually sparked another spark in me. I took this big painting that I got at the thrift store, Cams. It's in my bedroom. It's that autumn scene. It's a great big canvas. Mm-hmm. And I've known that I've wanted to like paint something, like modify it, because I like modifying thrift store paintings. And so what I've chosen to do is over the top of that autumn scene and these great big mod letters, I want to paint, "We are all just walking each other home."
Oh.
That or "Murder solves every problem." I can't decide one or the other.
Literally crying through my tears.
Crying and laughing through my tears. So a little postscript. One of the subjects in Katie's book who has been given a terminal diagnosis says this: "I don't think about myself as dying. I am living until proven otherwise, and I choose to live fully." Katie Butler adds, "You don't need a fatal diagnosis to live with this double awareness." So yeah, we are talking about death, but I feel like Katie's whole book continually affirms life.
Yes.
She called her book "The Art of Dying Well," but I think it could have been easily titled "The Art of Living Well." And that is exactly what I plan to do with it.
Oh, yes.
Thank you, Katie Butler.
Thank you, Susie Blackwell. I'm a hot mess.
Puddle. That was really a workout.
Shit.
Oh boy.
Susan.
Anything else we need to say to the good people?
Good one.
Thank you, Cam.
I'm gonna get that book.
I cannot recommend it highly enough. And I was talking to our friend Laura Youngkin, who is nowhere near 50 years old. She's in her mid-30s, and she was like, I need that book now. And I was like, there's no harm in it. I found it so life affirming, and it made me really just be like, get on it, say what you need to say, forgive who you need to forgive, make what you need to make, spark, spark, sparks.
And I think even for people who might not think they're ready for it yet, their parents maybe.
I don't think you're ready. That's right.
And you could begin that conversation together with your parents.
And I plan to do exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah. Really, really good point. Oh, that's it. We hope this put another bunch of sparks in your file. Listen, if there's a spark that you'd like for us to explore, we'll do it.
If
you've taken a spark and you've fanned it into a creative flame, and people are starting to do that too.
Yes, which is awesome.
Writing amazing books. Somebody's writing a children's book. I love it. If you'd like to share that with us, email us at thesparkfile@gmail.com or submit it through our website, even better, at thesparkfile.com.
We'll even take your feedback. But you know the price of admission. First, you got to share a creative risk that you've taken recently.
Oh, you know what? I've started requiring price of admission for anybody who writes. So if you have a question to ask us, if you have a mailbag for us, you still have to pay the toll. And I'm totally into it because I love hearing what brave creative risks people are taking.
Yes.
Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe, rate, 5-star review it. If you liked this podcast, share it with people you love. If you didn't like it, share it with your BFA roommate. They love it.
If something tickles your fancy and gets your creative juices flowing, we are writing you a forever permission slip to make that thing that's been knocking at your door. It's your turn to take a spark and fan it into a flame.
You got to walk it out. You got to talk it out. You got to Johann Sebastian Bach it out. You got to take it
and make it.
Sorry. Bye.
Bye.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my spark files. Could be something that I want to make or how I want to be. I pump it in my spark files. I jump into my spark files. Let's
let's open up the spark file.
Hi friends, it's Susan Blackwell from the Spark File, your one-stop shop for creativity where our doors are open. And if you smell something delicious, that's because Laura Camion and I have been cooking up something special, something designed to make a big difference in people's creative lives. Enter The Brave Creative, a free 5-day guided adventure to rediscover the vitality, energy, and possibility in your creative process. Whether you're a writer, a performer, a baker, a candlestick maker, navigating the creative process can be a bear. But never fear, there's power in numbers at the Spark File. So let's link arms and make the trip together. It's May 13th through 17th, 7 p.m. Eastern, less than 1 hour per day. And if you can't join live, don't worry about it. You can watch the replay. Join us by going to thesparkfile.com to register. And hey, if you're not familiar with the Spark File, first of all, welcome to the podcast. Secondly, we work with hundreds of creatives of all different kinds who are ready to take their next big step. We help folks fear less and create more in a community that is so fun and vibrant. And if you have joined us before, know that we are going deep with the Brave Creative. So buckle up, Buttercup. It is going to be an awesome adventure. Go to thesparkfile.com to register, but do it soon because it all starts May 13th. Thesparkfile.com. Register now.